Welcome back to another episode of WVU Marketing Communications Today. Live from West Virginia University, the syndicated show that sits at the intersection of data-driven decision-making and marketing practice with the experts who seem to know most, seem to know how to integrate those two together, like our host today here, Cindy Greenglass. Hey, Cindy.
Paul?
I'm good. We've missed you a week or two there, I think. We had some other rotating people through the chair.
We did. We have so many people interested in hosting. I can't hog this show all to myself here.
Well, we're glad to have you back with us today here. And I'm always, you know, that's such a interesting tease that you say. It sits at the intersection of data-driven decision-making and marketing practice. Is data really driving decisions these days, or is it all just the black art of guessing what people want?
Oh, I think the data is driving far more decisions than it has in the past. We definitely have a combination here of art and science. Data in and of itself doesn't really do anything.
Exactly.
It's right. Those of us as individuals that will apply our knowledge to it, apply our experience to it, that turns the data into the magic, which is the ability to make decisions from it. So in and of itself, data is not going to drive that decision. It's us that are able to make good decisions from the data that we're interpreting.
Well, today you brought a guest who's going to teach us how to treat data like a team member, like a friend, and not something to be feared here. So bring her on.
Hello. Do we have Angela Ann with us?
I think we do. And in fact, she told me that she took an extra cup of coffee so she could be extra energized here this morning for this conversation.
Well, I'm thrilled to have Angela with us today. Angela Ann, who's a news anchor for 10TV. What's so exciting, of course, for me to have Angela join us is she is a six-time Emmy Award-winning journalist. She co-anchors Central Ohio's number one weekday morning newscast. She is also 10TV's crime tracker reporter, focuses on crime concerns prevention in Central Ohio communities. She was named a 10 of 10 women leaders by Dress for Success Columbus, and has been honored by MAD of Central Ohio, and has co-presented on crime prevention, focusing on women and families, with a special demonstration of crime prevention through environmental design. Angela, in addition to her Emmys and her Best Reporter recognition, is a graduate of University of Southern California. She has a master's in strategic public relations. And probably, Paul, we got to be careful. We can't make her mad. She's also got a black belt in Taekwondo. Uh-oh. And is a classical pianist. What can I say?
You know, it would be a crime if you keep reading her bio. We don't hear from her here. That's all I can tell you.
So welcome, Angela.
Thank you. You guys are too kind. And I noticed I said good morning. That kind of shows you where my brain is right now. As a morning anchor, we get up at such odd hours of the day. So I wanted to make sure I was fresh for your listeners this afternoon.
Well, we are thrilled to have you with us. And Angela, I want to jump right in our session description. We were talking about turning statistics into a story, and we're going to hear from you how you filter out the noise and figure out how stories are relatable to your viewers in all these different various demographics. And you said to me you turn statistics into a story. So tell me, what do you mean by that in the context of your role?
Well, it's interesting when you guys were talking about the data. It's about how a person interprets the data. Which I know you guys are familiar with. But as journalists, we quantify when it comes to crime, whether crime's going up or going down, obviously looking at the data. And then you look at it over a certain period of time. You can either tell the story of, yes, crime is going up, and we turn those stats into a story. But I think the key role about being a journalist, too, is that you have to look beyond the numbers without just reporting what's on the surface of saying, yes, the data shows numbers going up or numbers going down. You have to go into the why and what's happening. And then you always, always end up finding another layer of data, which is what I love about what we do about journalism, is uncovering the truth. So while you have the numbers that might say, yes, looks like crime is getting worse in one neighborhood. But then if we look at another layer of data, is it because maybe you have more families moving out? Maybe you have more vacant buildings or vacant homes. And then you look at the reasons of what's driving that. And so that's when you start what I call peeling the onion of a story, where you peel away the layers until you finally get to the crux or the essence of what's happening in that neighborhood. And then that's how I find what makes that story relatable, not just to that neighborhood, but then maybe another neighborhood in another different part of town can take that story and that information and look at their own data and maybe try to fix the problem before we get to layer three or layer four of an issue.
Very interesting. Peeling the onion, I like that expression. It's so relevant to what we're talking about. You can see things very superficially, like you said, just reporting a statistic. But if you don't ask the question why, and then to get down into it to say that there's so many layers mm-hmm. to it. So how do you gather that data? How do you find those layers and gather that truthful data?
So that comes the tricky part, right? I mean, you can certainly get the crime analyst who will plot the data for you, whether it's looking at crime hotspots. So you simply plot the latitude, longitude onto a map, and boom, you can see where all the dots might cluster into one area versus another. That's one way where you can get the data very quickly, and if we had to, we could easily turn a story within a day or two based on what the crime analysts give back to us. The tricky part, though, then comes sometimes in that data, you'll always find that plus-minus margin of error. There was one time where I was doing an in-depth piece at looking at the intersections in Central Ohio that had the highest number of DUI crashes and arrests. And if you just plotted the data from an Excel spreadsheet of this road versus that road, and you looked at how that data was inputted, we found so many errors. And it wasn't by intentional. It was simply based on, well, you have 1,900 police officers in the city of Columbus, and they might enter a street based on a different name. So, for example, Hamilton Road is called Hamilton Road in East Columbus, but some officers like to call it by U.S. Route 317, and then that's how that's inputted. So then the data comes back with the same road, but in different analytics. So having that experience really shows that you can't just take what's right in front of you. You really have to look at what's in front of the number, what's behind the number, and then also what makes sense to you. Because at some point we're like, see, you know, you're looking at what you're plotting, and it just never made sense. And so it was a much lengthier investigative piece than we anticipated. But in the end, we still got back to what was important in that story, which was, when were these crashes happening? Where were they happening the most? So families could know which maybe areas to avoid around certain times of the day and what have you.
Awesome. So you brought up two really important factors that we look at when it relates to data capture. I'm sure you're familiar with, I hope our listeners are familiar with as well, the acronym GIGO, garbage in, garbage out, right? If you put dirty yeah. data or inaccuracies in, you're going to make bad decisions on bad data, right? But understanding that the data was bad, being able to recognize it, you brought up a really interesting point, which is intuition, or, you know, gut feel, or bringing your experience to it, that you saw something and you said, well, that just doesn't seem right, right? So you have to layer on to that, not just the raw data, but what you and your knowledge base allows you to determine that says that seems intuitively right or wrong. Did I hear you correctly?
Absolutely. And it's just something that you can be taught it in school to say, make sure you do X, Y, and Z. But until you make that first mistake and realize how big of a difference it can make in a story, you'll never forget it again, right? And so I remember I had a young producer who was, I was training to become a crime tracker producer, so I was throwing him statistics left and right. And he came back to me one day, and he's like, oh my gosh, look at this. They've had a 150% increase in robberies. And I said, yeah, but look at like the number that it started, which was like 4. And the number that it went to, you know, like, you have to look at that aspect of it. I'm like, so it's really not that big of a jump, even though percentage wise, and just to see like that light bulb go on someone who's young and trying to learn how to read data was a little rewarding in a way, but then it was also a little bit scary. Because if you don't have someone to do that checks and balance, you have to be really careful in our business.
Yes, well, and responsible, right? There's the responsibility that you have to your stakeholders and the audience. It's if you don't interpret that correctly, the consequences of those decisions can be quite big, right?
Absolutely, because had the producer gone on the air or had an anchor read what it was, it wasn't factually wrong. It was there. The numbers are there. But again, it's about the context.
Explain how you take that raw data then, and then you compile that in such a way that you can turn that into an investigation. So you mentioned you did an investigative report on DUIs, intersections, maybe about drug seizures, you know. How do you take all of that and connect the dot? What are the steps you take? How does that become an investigation from just data?
So one investigation we had was looking at what we called high on the highway. This was a few years ago. Exactly. And you're thinking, what? And stemmed from simply reading, I think, a police blotter where it just said somebody happened to be arrested by highway patrol and they found that the person was under the influence at the time. And I thought to myself, wait, under the influence of what? So further digging, the person had just shot up like minutes before getting onto the highway. Ooh. And I thought, well, this right. And I just thought, this is insane. So how often does this happen? So we went and got the data. We first got the data from Highway Patrol in terms of the number of drug seizures that they get across the state on the main highways. So there we had one set of data. And that led to another investigation, which was knowing which highways they patrolled more often and why. And so we were able to reveal the Route 23 pipeline, which goes north and south of Ohio, which basically connects all of the southern part of the U.S. where the drugs are coming in from Texas and all the way up into Ohio, and it takes it all the way up north into Chicago and beyond. So literally, like, we are a pipeline in the middle of Ohio for all these drugs, right? And so that's what the data showed. I mean, you plotted it, and you can see it light up, and literally, I caught it kind of like a mini Christmas tree. You had one line down the middle of Ohio, and then you had I-80, you had I-70, and then you had 75. But really, it was that kind of a look on the map. But what was more interesting was then we were able to extrapolate from some of those arrests where they actually had sat on surveillance, knowing that there were hot spots along the highway, rest areas, parking lots, where people would do their drug transactions as they were transporting the drugs across Ohio, and they would literally shoot up and then get back on the highway. And we were able to reveal, like, surveillance video and all this stuff. And so, again, it was relatable because who doesn't travel through Ohio when you're going someplace for the holidays? But
right.
It became this know what's going on, also know how to recognize a drugged driver as opposed to a drunk driver, and what to do. So it was, again, peeling that onion, going from one very easy set of data, which was, all right, where do you make your arrest, to then figuring out where are the worst highways and why. So we were able to reveal the pipeline and then dig it one step further into where people were shooting up.
Wow. This is awesome. So we're going to take a quick break so we can give Paul an opportunity to share with us what's going on his end. And when we come back, Angela, I want you to think about this while we're on break. This is great. You're showing us like a terrific and positive outcome of the stats and the data. And does it ever backfire on you? Have you ever had a negative experience? And I'll let you think about that for a couple minutes here while Paul takes it away from us.
Well, not for long, just for long enough to remind you that West Virginia University is the sponsor of this program and their online data marketing communications program, which is the first graduate program of its kind, focusing on strategic thinking, critical problem solving, and informed decision making. The data marketing communications program prepares you for your career by learning all these innovative tactics like those we're discussing today from award-winning faculty. Learn more at dmc.wvu.edu for Data Marketing Communications at West Virginia University. All right, I think I'm getting better at saying all those letters here in rapid succession here.
You're doing great. You've really improved, Paul. And ever since Integrate, when we were live at West Virginia University,
yes.
It's been so fun to introduce this podcast program to so many of our alumni, our current students, our national audience. And it was really fun to do a live in-studio version of the show.
So. It really was, especially rapidly as you had them sort of one chair rotating in and out of another one here. It was kind of interesting. I have a question for Angela because obviously she's in the heart of it here. Data, is data the story or is it about statistics and facts and figures or how do you turn that into a human story? That's always interested me here.
Well, and I will tell you that to me, I say you can turn any statistic into a story, but what makes a story memorable are the people in the story, the essence of a story.
Right.
Right? Because why do we collect data? We collect data to have that quantitative number, but it's the qualitative part of it that is going to resonate and stay with people and that will affect change. As a journalist, my job is to not only inform, but hopefully educate and empower people one way or the other. As I'm sure you guys are dealing with in West Virginia, we have a huge opioid issue in Ohio in the last year or two.
Yes.
And we started looking at data of drug overdose deaths. And as we just kind of kept looking at the numbers coming in, and every now you'd have a cluster, if you will, of drug overdose deaths, and it would maybe get 20, 30 seconds of airtime. Coroner's office sending out an alert, blah, 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 blah. There's a bad batch of heroin out there. And over time, you know that your viewers or listeners are saying, okay, we've heard this before. What does it mean? So we took data from the coroner's office, and we literally extrapolated male, female, age, race, everything we could think of, what types of drugs that the coroner listed as cause of death. Like, you name it, we separated it and then looked at it from a 360 view. What we noticed was that there was a significant age group between, don't quote me because this was a while ago that we did it, but probably between the ages of 28 and 45. Mostly white males, but probably about 65 males to females that were in this list of people who were dying the most from a record year of drug overdoses from opiates. What we also realized was, so we literally looked at their obituaries. Who are they? And as I looked at the obituaries, I kept seeing a theme. Survived by son, survived by daughter, survived by baby, and it struck me. And I said to my producer, our story isn't about the numbers. It's about the fact that this epidemic is killing a generation. And it's a generation of young parents who are leaving children behind to be raised by their grandparents or in the foster system. You pick. And it gives me goosebumps even saying that because I remember so vividly sitting in kitchens of families telling their story of how they lost their child and now they're raising their grandkids. So that to me is that relatable part, the compassion part of why we can't just tell numbers. We can't just tell the statistics.
Absolutely. It brings it home and makes it real to us, right? Relatable because it's real, because it brings it into our kitchen, it brings it into our homes. It makes us say, this could be me. It's not a statistic any longer. It's somebody I may know. It's I may be in touch with, or it could have happened to me. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Suddenly you pay attention to it in a much different way.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Angela, share with me if you've had it. I know I kind of put you on the spot there about, is it possible that the statistics can backfire on you? Is it possible that you've done all your work, you've got your data, and uh-oh, it didn't go according to plan?
100%.
Really?
Anything ever? Oh, yes. I'm not sure if anything ever goes according to plan. Our 9 a.m. editorial meeting is, hey, I've got this great story, and then at 2 p.m. it's, well, so this happened. It's always a shifting landscape, which kind of makes it fun and interesting. But that being said, early on in our Crime Tracker days, now this is back in 2002 or 2004 when Crime Tracker first launched here in Columbus, Ohio, but we noticed maybe only a couple other stations across the country doing something similar, where it was reporting beyond the one-off, the shooting, the robbery that happened. It was really looking at trends that were taking place. So we decided, and at that time it wasn't really crime, you couldn't really categorize it as crime, but it was looking at judges in the county. and Common Pleas judges, and we were looking at their timesheets and whether or not they were, quote-unquote, ripping off a taxpayer. Were they working their full 8 hours at work? I don't even think this was under Crime Track. It was just one of the investigative pieces I got assigned. And so we took the data, right? When do they key into work? And looking at their dockets and what are they doing, you know, during the day? Da 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 da. And we tracked it. And of course, most of them, like when they keyed out, it was, you know, noon or two or whatever, so on and so forth. And this was just such a naive mistake. But we found that there was another exit out of the judge's garage that you don't have to key out. So the data looked good, but then at that point we were like, what do you do, right? I mean, what can you do? And secondly, they're not required to work a full 8 hours like most people. So was it really ripping off the taxpayer? So this was one of those, like, early on, someone had this idea, and I don't remember, again, this was like almost 15 years ago, where they said, hey, you should check these judges because they're golfing all the time and they're going to lunch all the time. And so the I team decided, let's look at it. And as they looked at it, the data showed, oh, my gosh, you know, this judge came in at 8:45, they sat on arraignment court, and then they were gone by 11:45. And called it a day.
So, you know, that reminds me of something I always say to our classes at West Virginia University, which is, if you torture the data, it will tell you anything you want to hear. You know, bias is built into data based on our view of it and how we interpret it. And in this case, while the data wasn't lying, if you looked at it with a bias, you were trying to confirm a point of view or a preconceived idea. You could get the data to confirm it, but if you were looking at it from a different point of view, you would have seen that in and of itself, it didn't support the fact.
Exactly.
So we have to remember that anytime we look for data, we come with a bias, and we have to make sure that we park whatever that individual bias is at the door. We've got one last question that I think I have time to ask you here, Angela. And I wanted to talk about, if you would share with us and explain in your mind and opinion, what is the digital effect and how is search engine optimization or SEO data affecting the news cycle? You know, the whole world is 24/7 and digital in our news environment today. And how are you seeing that impact news from your professional point of view?
I would say that while it's exciting that you can look at the data of which stories are getting the most hits on the web or who has the highest share in the market based on what the SEO analytics comes back at, I think there's a downside to that as well, because what you're seeing the interest in viewers is what we call the clickbait type stories, right? And this story here, this story there, and they just read the headlines. And so they're like, oh, I like that. Click it. I'll share it. I'll tweet it. Retweet it. And so the more someone retweets my headline, the higher my status will be in terms of the share in the market. But the problem with that is, what is it that they're liking? Are they liking the journalism behind it? Are they liking just the shiny quarter is what I call it. So we do look at the digital platforms in terms of what viewers like, because that way you can gauge what they might consider is news. But one thing that someone said the other day, someone said, oh my gosh, this story is trending everywhere. Law enforcement, they're all sharing it. And it was a law enforcement-based story. And I said, yeah, it's trending everywhere on your social feed because you follow all those people. Doesn't mean it's trending everywhere. And it was kind of like this pause where they thought, oh, you're right. Again, it's kind of that taking a step back. And so the digital effect skewed that one journalist's view of what was a good story, but it was just a good story in their niche. It wasn't a bigger viewer benefit of how does this relate to all of Central Ohio as opposed to this one niche. So there's a little bit of drawback with that, but it does keep us on our game with the social media. So you just got to stay on top of it.
Well, you've really brought some very interesting perspective to news and reporting and how you tell stories and the human element of the story. And I want to thank you, Angela, so much for sharing your day with us and this insights that you've provided. If you have one last parting word for us, how would you like us to remember this segment with you as we say goodbye?
Well, you guys are very kind for having me first, so thank you very much. I think it's all in the interpretation of the numbers. And while you might see the numbers through your eyes, just remember that, at least for a journalist, who you're serving. So you can skew the data to serve, whether it's a company that has a special interest or what have you. As a journalist, we're serving the public's interest. And so that is the key for me when I interpret data.
Terrific. Thank you again, Angela. What a great time we've had and really insightful. And we wish you and all of our listeners a very good afternoon.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to WVU Marketing Communications Today, brought to you live from West Virginia University, a biweekly program that sits at the intersection of data-driven decision-making and marketing practice, only on the Funnel Radio Network, for at-work listeners like you.